Hello and welcome to this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lab. No, I'm not in the home studio. I know I'm not exactly servicing the audio listeners here, but I am in Stamford, Connecticut, home of NBC Sports. I'm in town for a TV feature meeting. If you or a loved one have a profile subject you'd like to see in 2024, hit me up in the comments and maybe we'll do a deep dive on TV in 6.5 minutes time. Rex, you are home, however, before heading down to Miami for the LIV team finale. That actually seems like a good place to start. That's called a professional segue. Last week, we could have, probably even should have, done an emergency pod on the official world golf ranking decision, 15 or 16 months in the making, deciding not to award LIV Golf official world golf ranking points. What was your reaction to that news when it dropped?
A bit of a surprise. I'm not going to lie. I was actually talking with some producers before we knew the news was coming. We didn't know what the news was. And in a meeting with some of our producers, my logic was, I don't know that they would just come out right now and say no. It seems to me that given what's going on in golf right now with the framework agreement, trying to get to some sort of definitive agreement, I would have thought they wanted to kick the can on this one. That's not the case at all. Before I get to that, however, I got to get this off my chest because it left me filled with rage last week. And I almost texted you about it. And bunkmate, lock yourself in a room for an entire day to binge watch the David Beckham doc. I don't know if you've seen it. Don't even know if you've heard about it. Apparently it's brilliant. Apparently it's really, really good. Apparently she knows nothing about soccer, but she literally locked herself in the room, loved every single minute of it. After about 12 hours, she came out having not taken a shower, eaten for 12 hours. And she looks at me and she says these words out loud. That's better than the Michael Jordan doc. Number one, she doesn't even know the name. Yeah, exactly. Doesn't even know the name of the Michael Jordan Fight doc. Words. And that's ridiculous. I've never heard anything so stupid or dumb in my entire life. I'm going to go ahead and say that about my beautiful wife, because I cannot believe that she would say that about The Last Dance, which was, in my opinion, one of the best documentaries I think I've ever seen. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, Last Dance literally got me through the early stages of the pandemic.
Like, not everybody through COVID.
Yeah, that like could not have dropped at a better time. I have heard very positive things about the David Beckham documentary. When you said that bunkmate locked herself in a room, I literally thought that she had locked herself in a room. That is actually more plausible. That's actually more understandable than this hot take thinking that the Beckham documentary could possibly be better than The Last Dance. I know some journalistic purists kind of were nitpicking about the Last Dance and that Jordan kind of okayed it as one of the executive producers. That's like what it takes now. Like megastars. I was just reading a profile about Taylor Swift and how this New York Times magazine reporter was kind of lamenting the fact that Taylor Swift has not done a magazine profile since 2019. If you're of a particular stature, like you don't need the media anymore. If you're Jordan, you don't need this outside entity to come profile you or do a documentary on. Like you want to have all hands on deck. I understand it. To me, that is the preeminent sports doc of a 21st century. But I also have not watched the David Beckham documentary, but I'll put that on my to-do list.
I've watched a little bit of it. It's very good. And to your point, I think that's a better point that you're making. Yes, I think if you watch the Michael Jordan doc with the goggles that you and I wear professionally as journalists, of course, there were things that came up in that because you had to get the nod from Michael Jordan to make any of this work that just seemed to be glossed over. There were things about his retirement that I wanted to hear more about, having been in the business. I was working at the Orlando Sentinel at the time. I was kind of on the fringe connected to these stories because of them playing the Orlando Magic. I was covering the minor league baseball team. So I went to Birmingham to cover the Barons when he was on there. So yeah, there was plenty of things that stood out that I was like, I would have liked to have seen that. I don't know that The Last Dance is as egregious as that University of Florida doc that came out just a few weeks ago. Now that's awful.
Dreadful.
Yes. I don't want to see a doc that Urban Meyer wants anything to do with. Like that in my mind is that's where you cut it off. That no, like if he agrees to be in this, then that's not the doc I probably want to watch. I want to watch the documentary that talks about, and I think someone did a list of like the top 20 things that they missed in that documentary. And it's not number one nor number two, but there's two separate murderers on that team. And both of them were missed, and neither one of them were in the top five of the 20 things that they missed, which I thought, well, that's pretty telling. I think this Beckham doc, and I've just watched a little bit of it, it clearly got his seal of approval. So again, you have to sort of look at it through a certain lens, knowing that he's not going to tell the full story. There are things in there that I was pretty surprised. Like, I didn't know much about David Beckham, to be honest with you, other than he was just really, really good at kickball. But
handsome.
He signed off
with some things.
Very handsome fella. Married well. So I know those things. That's about the extent of it. However, there were some embarrassing moments in there. Like, there were some sad moments in there. There's some moments early in his career when he sort of let down England in the World Cup. So he did sign off on the tough moments. I'm sure it's good. Last Dance. She's out of her mind.
But, like, if you're doing a documentary and you want to make it as good as possible, you have to understand that you have to also include the negative moments or the moments that maybe would ding your reputation a little bit to make it a more complete and authentic view. Like, no one is perfect, especially a person with his level of stature. Like, that's what everyone should be doing who does a documentary, which is why I've never understood why there hasn't been a good Tiger doc. Like, if you actually had a genuine Tiger sit down and reflect on all of his missteps in a genuine, authentic way, that could garner him so many more fans than what the apology happened in 09.
Yeah, he's not doing that. And this is apropos because you're in Connecticut right now. And you're in Stanford, which I'm sure is beautiful this time of year. The leaves must be
not
turning
bad.
Colors on the trees. Yeah, I'm sure you're enjoying yourself. Sounds like you're going to have a lovely dinner with Lil Russ tonight. So good luck for both of you guys. I don't know who's picking up that check because you both have alligator arms. However, you're talking about exactly what you're trying to do this week. So I think you ran into this the last few years where you've wanted to do deeper dives on, and I'm not going to name any names, but Player X. And Player X pushed back on certain subject matter, and there's nothing you can do. Your hands are tied. As much as you like to tell that story, there's nothing you can do.
Yes, that's certainly true. We're also limited on the Golf Channel by time. Like, that's our biggest constraint. Typically, TV segments are 8 minutes, unless Brandel really has a point to make, and then they're going to stretch it to 10, 10, 11, 12 minutes before they have to go to break. But typically on Live From, where these TV features are going to air, is 8 minutes. So we essentially have 6.5 minutes to do a TV feature if you go in the tee to lead into it, and then the tag on the back end, which I'm hoping Rich Lerner's doing off a teleprompter. However, so 6.5 minutes, we have to have the main subject's approval and understanding to be able to tell his story in 6.5 minutes of time. Like, can we get in depth? Not particularly. You basically have to have a theme and you're trying to get supporting sound. Would we love to do 30-minute, 60-minute features? Like, yeah, I would absolutely love to do that. I thought Golf Channel, in collaboration with USGA, did an amazing feature on the Adaptive Open this year with a guy from Ukraine. Like, it was awesome, but it was 20-something minutes long. And, like, to get that on linear television, you need to basically – front that cost because you're losing the advertising that would happen. So we're definitely constrained. I see what you're trying to say. Like, for what we're doing, yeah, like, I can't do a Tom Kim feature necessarily in 6.5 minutes without Tom Kim's voice in it, right? Like, you could talk to everyone around Tom Kim, and we did talk to everyone around Tom Kim, even those who were shut off, but we also needed Tom Kim in there. So it's different. TV features like what we're planning for 2024 is certainly different than these full-length documentaries, which require time, access, and full participation from everyone involved.
So that was a very, very rambling, very, very gas bag way to get to what I can't believe my wife thinks anything's better than The Last Dance. So please, you guys are really, really good. But leaving us comments on that one, please comment on that one. To go back to on the world ranking in Live Golf, it I kind of looked at it through two – full circle. Looked at it through two lenses. One, the micro, which probably shouldn't have been surprised because all of the issues that the official world golf ranking had with Live Golf, the format, 48-man fields, 54-hole tournaments, a focus on team golf, which they don't like. That makes them uncomfortable. That had not changed. The big one, there's really no legitimate pathway to get onto Live Golf. There is a qualifying tournament, but we really haven't seen it in action. It doesn't look like there's going to be a big wholesale turnover from year to year. Those things have been an issue for the world ranking since the beginning, and those things haven't changed. So I guess in the micro, that didn't surprise me. In the macro, as I pointed out, it does, given where we are in the state of golf at the moment. It, from a purely political point of view, where we're all trying to make this work, we're all trying to become one big happy family, the fact that the governor of the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia, who I just was going to try to say his name, then I panicked and then ran scared to
Nasir Al-Rumayyan.
I don't think you got it. I given the fact he played in the Dunhill just a few weeks ago alongside Peter Dawson, alongside some of the members of the quote unquote ecosystem that we have going on in golf right now, it that does surprise me, because it seems to me it would have been more advantageous to kick this can at least until December, when we might have a better idea. I don't believe that's a hard deadline in December for the definitive agreement at all. I believe that we'll probably get there and they'll say, no, we're going to give it 6 more months or whatever the case may be. Well, I don't know why you just wouldn't have kicked that can and just see where we are 3 months from now. And the idea that this was simply a non-starter for the world ranking. They just were not going to allow this to happen because of the implications of what it could mean to sort of, I don't want to say pollute, but certainly disrupt what they're trying to do with the ranking.
Yeah, and it wasn't even so much the format of the tournaments. Yeah, the team angle made a little bit messy. They brought up the Sebastian Munoz, who hit a long birdie putt in Orlando, and he thought more about the team race and protecting that as opposed to going for the individual title. Like, that's really hard to kind of nitpick with each and every tournament. You could even get around the 48-man fields, the 54 holes, the no cuts. Like, there's a mathematical formula that the OWGR can use. It really came down to the issue of being a closed shop for LIV. The fact that four players, and just four players alone, get relegated after each year. They just made that cutoff after the tournament in Saudi Arabia with Chase Koepka, which makes things very interesting, with Brooks Koepka's brother no longer part of LIV Golf unless he somehow gets promoted in this Q School type thing at the end of the year. Jed Morgan, Siwon Kim, who battled the Yips. I talked to him at the PGA Championship earlier this year. Really, really struggling. And James Pyatt, the former U.S. Amateur champion, of the four players who are not going to be a part of LIV Golf. Is anyone going to miss those players? No, absolutely not. If LIV was smart, they would lean in to this promotional and relegation year. I don't know if it's by making more players in the league. If you have 60 and you're cutting to 12 or cutting 16, whatever the case may be. I don't know if it's making it 24 who are not going to be guaranteed their cards for the following year. There definitely seems to be some wiggle room. And so I'm curious, Rex, like Peter Dawson in comments to Global Golf Post, our friend Ron Green Jr., as well as a couple other outlets like the AP, he seemed to leave open the possibility that if LIV makes some adjustments to their format and to how they operate, they could eventually get rubber stamped here. It's just a matter of if LIV wants to do it. Like, will the OWGR set out guidelines saying, hey, we need to see 12 players get relegated, and then we'll rubber stamp this? Or does LIV kind of not want to change its identity, which 2 years in, I'm not sure if that's what they're thinking.
Well, the other half of this conversation, and to that point, is what we heard from the LIV side. And I expected there to be a lot of pushback from players, and that wasn't the case at all. I think Bryson DeChambeau did a really good job of saying, I was texting actually the day it happened with another LIV player who kind of echoed the same sentiments, that they've gone so far down the road without world ranking points. I think the word that one player used to me is the points have already been decimated as far as the LIV players go. I think there's only one inside the top 50 in the world. I think there's only three Brooks. Inside the top 100. Yeah. So even if they did get world ranking points starting today, it's not going to be that they're not going to get enough points at each one of their individual events now to make that big of a difference going forward. The other side of this argument is, and Bryson said this and some other players I spoke to on the LIV side, it's up to the major championships now, and they can circumvent the whole idea behind wanting to get world ranking points and just carve out some sort of category for whatever number you want, the top five on the LIV money list, the top 10, whatever the case may be. And if you look at what happened, not just this year, but also last year in the major championships, Brooks won, Brooks contended at the Masters. You look, other players sort of, made cameos on top of leaderboards. I think it's up to the major championships at this point to recognize that without the LIV players in the field, their fields are hurting, and they probably need to carve out some sort of exemption. And that way this is a non-issue.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more. They do this with basically every other tour under the sun, whether it's literally the Sunshine Tour, the Korean Tour, the Japan Tour. There is a category in most major championship fields to exempt the top X number of players into that. I think LIV has proven itself, and the caliber of players, at least in the top end, have proven themselves. So where if it's the PGA Championship, right, and they typically get the top 100 from the official World Golf Ranking, unofficially, of course, but they say, look, as of April 25th, we're taking the top three or five points earners from the LIV standings this year, or you go back to the 2023 point standings and automatically exempt those players who would otherwise not be eligible. You mentioned Brooks, but you have Bryson DeChambeau, who challenged at the PGA Championship. Cam Smith is literally a year removed from being arguably the best player in the world. Dustin Johnson won a major championship within the past half decade. I'm with you that that's the easiest fix, and how if you're on LIV right now, you wouldn't be too concerned thinking that it's the major's imperative to put together the best possible field for their championships. If they're smart, they would include at least some of a LIV players. What I was most curious about, Rex, is how this affects LIV's recruiting efforts of potential PGA Tour players. You remember when the framework agreement came out, right? They said, you know, we're going to be putting a pause on some of the recruiting efforts of LIV trying to poach some more PGA Tour players. That went away a couple of weeks after that. I guess the DOJ investigation looked into that and said that probably wouldn't be such a good idea. What do you think this means now, Rex? Would any PGA Tour players actually be tempted to jump to LIV if you can't get world ranking points? Because it seems like if you're a high caliber player who aspires to play in major championships, that kind of be a big turnoff for you, wouldn't it?
I mean, you're making the assumption here that the players who already jumped to LIV Golf believed wholeheartedly, 100%, in what Greg Norman told them. And I think if they did, then they're foolish. Then they're foolish. They're getting bad advice. I know Greg and LIV Golf argued from the very, very beginning that no, we'll end up with world ranking points. I think his argument even included they'll be retroactive. That we'll get them quickly, and then we do get them, they'll circle back around and start giving us
points. Can't suspend it for even one day.
Yeah. So anybody who believed that either got really, really bad advice or probably shouldn't be making those kinds of big decisions that impact your household anyway. To that point, I think if there's enough money, absolutely. And I've been told by two people inside LIV that even though it's they've kind of sent up the white flag right now, that you're right, that LIV Golf is not poaching players, that there's a big board at LIV right now, a literal big board with names on it. And it's probably not the big names that you would expect, but they still have their eyes on players. They're still looking to grow. They're still looking to expand. To your point, they would love to give Brooks Koepka an opportunity because clearly Chase isn't going to be on that team, and clearly Matt Wolf's not going to be on that team. So Brooks has got to figure out how he's going to fill out the rest of the team. I think they have a plan going forward. That's why, like, I am curious this week when I do get to Doral for their season finale. I really want to hear from the other side. Like, how do the LIV players and the LIV administrators think this is going to play out after December 31st? That, let's say there is some sort of definitive agreement. How do they imagine their world is going to integrate into the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour? Because I don't think we've really heard from that side. I think from their point of view, it's still an open void. They have no idea.
I was just going to ask, what's kind of your goal or mission when you head down to Miami this year?
Number one.
Oh, well, naturally. Yeah. No. Naturally, you. Sure. It's clearly, we're talking about number two or three on the list. It does seem, and I've been struck by the fact that no LIV player has publicly criticized LIV, whether the model, the format, the decision. No one said they're misled, and that's obviously understandable when you're thinking about the bosses who are controlling the purse strings of LIV Golf. And I think anyone who is not under contract is probably a little bit fearful of where the playing status could look in 2024. But, like, are players, do players feel like they're misled? Even anonymously, Rex, we have not heard any players openly grousing. It seems like players are genuinely happy that they made the move and aren't necessarily regretting their decision to not play in the Shriners Children's Open of the world, and there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of wishing to come back to the PGA Tour, if not for a couple of select handful of events.
I've had players tell me sentimentally there's things that they missed. I mean, certainly the Ryder Cup was on a lot of guys' list. They probably
can still play on it. Just play better.
Well, the Europeans could not because they had turned down their membership, and there was issues going on there. But, and again, that was, you could argue that's self-inflicted as well. I think certain players probably miss certain events, whatever the case may be. But by and large, what I've gotten back from the players that I've talked to over there is they're not 100% sure they even want to come back. And the idea here being that let's put this into the context of everyday life. If you're a police officer and you're working 5 days a week for X amount, and someone says, no, I'm going to four times your salary and you only have to work 2 days a week. Tell me what the motivation is to go back to 5 days a work week for the other salary. That's essentially what we're talking about here. And it's easy for us to all roll our eyes and ask how much money is too much money, because it's really easy for us as fans to spend other people's money. However, in this particular case, you're talking about a quality of life that's hard to compare. You're talking about players who went from probably playing 25, maybe even, well, if you're Patrick Reed, you played 35 events a year, to now you only have to play 14. You may add a handful in there. So by the time it's all said and done, 18, maybe tops by the end of the year. Some of them have said that's probably not enough to stay competitively sharp. However, it's a good lifestyle. And I don't know that any player will voluntarily walk away from that.
Have you found yourself watching more or less LIV golf tournaments this year? Obviously, the curiosity has kind of wound down after last year. I think everyone was intrigued what it looks like. Why were players attracted to it? Will it someday overtake the PGA Tour? I guess if you're a PGA Tour supporter, those fears have been sort of allayed as of 2023. I have not personally found myself watching much, save for a handful of players. I don't miss most of the guys who are on LIV. I found the schedule kind of confusing, clunky, uninspiring. It had a weird 6-week dip late in the summer when you'd think they'd want to capitalize on any sort of momentum that they'd had with Brooks. Obviously, you can't foresee that he's going to win a major championship, but still 6 weeks off in any sport is a very bad idea for business. What are your takeaways, Rex, on what we've seen from LIV Golf this year?
I'm with you, probably less. That said, I did watch Sunday from Jeddah just because I was curious. I was curious about the golf course. There's a professional curiosity. I know some folks on that broadcast, and I am always kind of curious, like, what are they doing differently that maybe no one else that's covering PGA Tour events is doing? But no, you're right. I probably would agree with it. There's nothing that stood out, and I don't know, maybe it would be different. I'd probably pay attention this week if I wasn't going down to Doral to cover it. There's nothing that stands out. They don't go to a course and have these head-to-head matchups that force me to wherever it is on the CW, whether it's on the app or if it's on, you know, the linear lines. You're right. It's hard to sit here and imagine a day when it's better than the PGA Tour, when you can argue that the product is better than the PGA Tour. But in their mind, in their blueprint, they feel like eventually they can get there.
I still don't think they've captured the team golf element. It's still very much like college golf at this point, where you're playing four guys and you add up your score at the end of the day. If they can somehow incorporate that better, if they can lean into some of the trades and the relegation, yeah, the promotion, like we touched on at the beginning of the podcast, I still think some of the actual, like, peripheral stuff as it relates to LIV is the most appealing aspect to it. And that's not necessarily going to be a big selling point, because the tournament competition is still, when it comes down to it, 18 holes of stroke play. All right, over on the PGA Tour side, you have the Shriners Children Open, won by Tom Kim. We'll get into him in a second. But for at least the first 2 days, the story, Rex, was Lexi Thompson. We touched on her in last week's podcast. You boldly proclaimed that she was going to make the cut. I kind of scoffed at that notion. And then about an hour to play in her second round, I almost waved the white flag. Did not. She ended up missing the cut by three shots. But I don't know about you, I came away highly impressed with Lexi Thompson's performance, especially considering this has been by far the worst season of her career.
Actually, Goldie, cut in that sound right here from what I said, because what I actually said last week, and Goldie's not going to do that because apparently he only does that for you. But what I actually said was, I wouldn't be surprised if she does make the cut, because we were having this conversation about where we imagine she could land in the field. And I think I used the Padraig Harrington example to kind of throw it out there, that I asked him last year at the Irish Open, and this is why Padraig is the absolute best. I asked him, what are your thoughts on the golf course? And it was for a Golf Central interview, so it was on camera. And I'm holding the microphone for more than 5 minutes as he rambles and gas bags and just yammers on for over 5 minutes. And he finally gets to the end, and the last sentence is, and that is why in my lifetime, a woman will win on the PGA Tour. And I turned, and normally those things go two or three questions, four questions, whatever the case may be. I had him turn the camera off, and I turned to the European Tour media official, and I go, you know how that question started, right? I started with your thoughts on the golf course, and somehow we went on this big, long train ride until we finally ended up, that's why a woman will win on the PGA Tour in my lifetime. to Podrick's point and why he's brilliant is because he was pointing out the differences are the margins aren't nearly as wide as they once were between the women's game and the men's game. And I wrote about this on Friday because I was taken, and this is just Thursday stats. I haven't had a chance to go back and look at Lexi's Friday stats, but she was near the bottom of the field in driving distance. She wasn't bottom at all. I think she was 97th out of 142. It's a 132 field. So she was near that. She was in the bottom third, but she wasn't the bottom. She wasn't the shortest player in the field for whatever reason. We can sit and go through that, but she was picking up strokes from the fairway with her irons. And it suddenly dawned on me, if you go back to when Annika did the breakthrough or when Michelle Wee did the breakthrough, we really didn't have these numbers that we could break this down and say statistically, this is what she does well enough to compete on the PGA Tour, and this is what she doesn't do well enough to compete on the PGA Tour. But if you did that with Lexi, at least through one round, you can make an argument that if she got hot with a putter, there's no reason why she shouldn't make the cut.
Yeah, like to your point, with the stats, like she gained strokes off the tee in round two. She gained strokes with her approach. In round one, I thought she acquitted herself great. And it wasn't even like she was, you know, holing 50-foot bombs for birdie. It wasn't like she was holing chip shots or bunker shots. Like, she was just playing her standard round. Like, she literally missed two fairways and four greens in regulation on Friday in her round of 69. She's at 73 in the opening round, kind of a sloppy double bogey, a derailed her progress there. But, like, she played much of Friday either inside or around the cut line. And I saw inevitably it lead to the discussion of will more LPGA players now get a shot to play on the PGA Tour? And I want to pause that conversation, Rex, and appreciate Lexi. Lexi is a unicorn on the LPGA. Like, she was hitting 310-yard drives at a PGA Tour venue. She is top 10 on driving distance. She has always been among the tour leaders in distance ever since she broke on the LPGA more than a decade ago. She is a unicorn in that respect. You look at the best players on the LPGA, whether it's two-time major champion this year and Lilia Vu or Jin Young Ko or Celine Boutier, who won the Evian this year, or even Rose Zhang. Like, I love Rose Zhang. I think the world of Rose Zhang. I think Rose Zhang is going to be an absolute world beater when she finds her footing as a professional. Those players typically average 240, 250, 260 off the tee. That just can't play at PGA Tour venues. I don't care if you're playing Colonial, one of the shortest courses on the PGA Tour. Like, you just can't expect to be hitting three woods, five woods, hybrids into par fours and think that you can compete at a high level on the PGA Tour. That's why Lexi was and is the perfect player to kind of test her skill set. Nelly Korda, to an extent, could have that, but she doesn't quite have the raw power that Lexi Thompson does. Lexi
probably
Thompson
a more
is the
complete
best
game,
bet.
Though. You could argue. I mean,
oh yeah,
probably more
I mean,
complete
look,
game than Lexi. Yeah,
like look, Lexi hasn't won on the LPGA in 4 years until a couple of weeks ago. Like, she wasn't even guaranteed to have her status this year yet. She's not the best player on the LPGA, but does she play the most PGA Tour centric game? Yes, I would argue she does, and that's where I'd like to keep it with these sponsor exams. I don't think this should actually necessarily open the floodgates for more of these types of invites.
No, and I don't disagree. I think this applies to the same conversation we have about the men. I pointed to Adrian Meronk on numerous occasions, saying that this is sort of the future of golf. He could have played any other sport. I've asked him about this before. He was a basketball player growing up. He was a handball player growing up. You know my affinity for handball after the Summer Olympics. He could have done anything and been really, really good at it. And he chose at 6'5", 190-something pounds, to be a golfer. Golf hasn't seen those players, at least not on a regular diet, where they're just bigger, stronger, faster. I would imagine it's going to be the same thing for the women's game, that, yes, Lexi Thompson stands alone in the women's game right now as someone who could probably show up at a random tour event like Vegas and somehow find a way to, if not contend, but at least make the cut. You're right. I don't think the women's game is there right now. I think Podrick's point, and I was sort of piggybacking on that last week, is you can see the evolution, and the evolution says it's going to happen eventually.
Yes, I don't think that time is anytime soon. Could happen in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. Who knows? Maybe yes. I'm still leaning towards no. How about the guy, Rex, who actually won the tournament? That was Tom Kim.
Your boy Tom.
Defended his title in Vegas, just 21 years old. Believe I became the youngest three-time winner on the PGA Tour since a man named Tiger Woods all the way back in 1996. What do you think of young Tom's major prospects for 2024? How much better can this kid get? He's up to a career high 11th in the world ranking at this point.
Oh, I think he can get much better. I mean, when you look at what he does well right now, and I think probably Victor Hovland is the litmus test here, right? I think both of us, you and myself, probably rolled our eyes every time we saw him getting in contention, and we always would make the line, he's going to have to chip a shot eventually. And now you go back to the conversation you had with him at the Open this year when he's hitting those spinny shots off an incredibly tight lie, and he sort of gets that smile and turns to you. Remember when people used to think, I can't do that? He turned a weakness into a strength. If Tom continues on that same road, and I don't know why he wouldn't, because he's driven, he's motivated just like Victor is. Yes, I think there's plenty of upside for him. I will say it is curious that there was a good stretch in this year when he did not look like the world beater, when he did not look like the kid that you did the big feature on, when he did not look like the kid from the President's Cup last year, or the player, I guess is a better way for me to say that, the player from the President's Cup last year, and he looked average. I mean, I'll go ahead and say it. And I'm curious, is that going to become the norm, or is that a one-off? I think he's still so young in his career, we don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there was certainly a point. I'm looking at the stats right now from February and the Phoenix Open all the way through the U.S. Open. He did not have a single top 10 in a PGA Tour event. Wasn't happy with the swing, ended up changing swing coaches. Was dealing with a little bit of a nagging injury, but I think it's still worth pointing out, Rex, that he's got a pretty complete game for 21. Three top 16 finishes in the major championships this year. Of course, the T2 at the Open Championship. Cannot wait to see the Netflix episode on Tom Kim. If you recall, back at the Open, Rex, he had that slip prior to the tournament and was dealing with what was essentially a mildly sprained ankle. It was, at least for the cameras, portrayed quite heroically. So I am curious to see how that one plays when the new Netflix season drops in February. There's certainly some the cynics among us, I think, could potentially have a field day with that one. But there's no disputing that Tom Kim is an immense talent. The thing that you, when you mentioned Victor Hovland in kind of adding the short game shots to his repertoire, the thing with Tom Kim is that he doesn't have that glaring weakness. What he does not do well, however, is hit it very long off the tee. He's outside the top 100 in driving distance. Now, he's incredibly accurate. I think he's seventh on the PGA Tour in accuracy, but he averages 297. That's long for folks like us, but not long as it relates to PGA Tour players. I remember back at the CJ Cup, I was covering it with Rory. I covered the opening round, and those two were paired together. And I posed the question to Rory, like, what advice would you have for Tom at this point in his career? Right at that point, he was just 20, and I think he just won on the PGA Tour. He said, don't change anything. He goes, there's going to be a temptation for him to chase distance, to see that he's lagging 10, 15, 20 yards behind these guys and want to make some change that can add a little bit more firepower to his game. Rory says, you do everything else so well that you have to resist that temptation. I'm just curious to see if Tom Kim can do it. That was always the thing about Jordan, wasn't it? They said, look, you've got this incredible touch on and around the greens. You're a terrific iron player. Yes, your average length, maybe even a little bit below average length. He ended up chasing distance, found himself in the wilderness for 4 or 5 years. I'll be curious to see if Tom Kim avoids that fate that so many players have fallen victim to.
No, it's a good concern, and you're right, if you're going to pick out a weakness in that. And he's such a bright spot. When we go back to last year, I mean, last year's President's Cup seems like a lifetime ago, but he was the only thing that made that tournament's, that cup, that match entertaining even in the least. And it was going to be another blowout. It was going to be another eye roll, and why do we have to do this every 2 years? And he just injected that entire team and that entire event with life. It wasn't there, and you're right, to go to the Open Championship, I will be curious – not only to see how that Netflix episode plays out, but a lot of Netflix episodes play out. I just don't know if he's going to be the type of player where 3 years from now we're talking about him as the player of the year. Because I was kind of doing my mental checklist for the GWA player of the year ballot this morning. And I'm kind of, well, it's pretty straightforward. But then Brooks's name kind of came up, and I started writing some stuff down and trying to figure out, is he going to, we in another conversation for another day. I see the wheels already spinning.
How many names do you have to have on the ballot?
We can have as many as we want. This is for the Golf Writers Association of America. Players of the Year, senior players.
There's just three names.
Okay.
Rom, Scotty, and Victor Hovland. Those are the only three players who would warrant.
Brooks will be on the ballot.
If any other player warrants a vote as the Player of the Year for 2023 as a GWA member, their membership should be revoked. I know we're going to be getting those cute little membership cards, like a AAA card that you can show in times of distress. We're going to have that as Golf Writers Association of America members. No, that card needs to be revoked. You have to get an e-card from now on because you just don't know anything about golf if you think it's any other than those three players.
No, I think Brooks could be an interesting conversation in the context of Tom Kim. Is he going to have a season where he just plays so well from start to finish? And you can pencil in how many victories that is. I'm not even getting caught up on that. Is he going to have one of those years where just consistently – look, you can say what you want about Scottie Scheffler's season. There are a lot of players, at least at Eastlake, were saying that, yeah, man, I would love to have his season compared to, let's say, John Rahm, even compared at that point to Victor Hovland, just because of the consistency of it. I wonder, is Tom Kim going to have that in his career? He might. I'm not saying he doesn't. He clearly has all the skills, but it's really, really hard to get to that level.
Yeah, like, can he win 4, 5, 6 times in a season? I have a hard time imagining that. If you invoke the name of another young hotshot, even though he's 23, 3 years older than Tom, or 2 years older than Tom Kim, like Ludvig Åberg, who has been dominating the news over the past couple of months, like, who do you think is more capable of having a 4, 5, 6 win season and potentially becoming Player of the Year on the PGA Tour? I would lean towards Ludvig Åberg just because of the firepower aspect. He's more of a birdie machine than Tom Kim is, but I could also see Tom Kim having 4 top tens. I could see him top 10 in every single major championship in a year. He's just that complete. He's that self-assured. And I think he really has the game that could handle all those types of tests.
I recognize that room behind you. That's the courtyard in Stamford, Connecticut, where you are this week. You're going through meetings at Golf Channel headquarters. I am curious, and I mean this, please, anyone, you guys are really good about leaving comments. Like, if you're staying in Stamford, like, what should you absolutely do? Like, if you come to Orlando, I have a list of things, and none of them are going to be the Disney or any of the theme parks. Like, I'd be curious, what are the top 5 things you should do when you're in Stamford?
But yeah, I mean, I would certainly love to hear that list other than just eat, drink, go to the gym, something along those lines. I will say the only other time I've been to Stamford was last December. You and I split shifted a Golf Today hosting duties. I'm assuming we'll have to do that once again in 2023. Understandably, everyone saves their vacation time and then takes off the entire month of December, leaving literally no one else with a pulse to host the show. That is why they call on you and I. I did not do much that week. If memory serves, the show was from like 12 to 1, which is a little bit weird. You can't do anything in the morning. And in the afternoon, you're doing like post-planning meeting, FaceTime with the kids. And then I would just like watch TV. It was 40 degrees and rainy out. Like, I have no idea what you can do in Stanford. I will say, Rex, it's beautiful out. It's like 57 degrees. We're supposed to have a lovely Italian dinner tonight with Lil Russ. And Anna Jackson, almost called her Anna Whiteley, how she still remains in my phone. And then a big Monday Night Football game. Looking forward to catching up with Jared Ficklin, our TV feature extraordinaire. He and I will kick around some ideas for the features for 2024. I'm not sure if I've ever said this publicly, but I'm trying to fill like the Tom Rinaldi role that he used to have for ESPN on Golf Channel's Live From. I want to be that dude, when you turn on Live From, you're like, man, it's Live From the Masters. I wonder what Lav cooked up for a TV feature this year. Like, I want to have that sort of anticipation or excitement. Not saying we'll ever get there. Tom Rinaldi is the GOAT, but we can aspire to try to reach that sort of status.
Look at you reaching new heights, coming to epiphanies in the middle of the podcast. This has been a special podcast. You, Tom Rinaldi.
Really has. Rex, what do you have on the grill? I know you'll be going to Miami, but then what do you have? We're only, let's see.
I'll be back Saturday. Yeah, I'll be back for football Saturday.
We're only 12 days away from Georgia, Florida.
Well, and we have – that's true. And that'll actually be a pretty good game by the looks of it right now. And it's going to be – it's going to feel like fall in Florida. That must be killing you. It feels like fall for the first time since really last fall in Florida. I will say this, that, and I've done this a couple of times now. I've talked about my utter defeat when it comes to trying to do burn-ins with pork bellies. Like last time, I just literally threw them away. Wouldn't even let any of the kids just even touch them. So I tried it again this Saturday just to give it a shot. And I took a much deeper dive in the research. And I'm telling you, they turned out unbelievably good. And the trick is, I did not know this, that you have to use a ton of brown sugar. You have to use a ton of agave. And on these particular ones, they were like, kind of like lime tequila. And so I used a ton of tequila and lime. And it just, the way it mixes and the way it caramelizes, I'm going to do them again next Saturday.
I mean, I don't disagree that pork belly burnt ends are delicious. The thing that's always a hang up for me is how many can you actually consume without feeling nauseous? Like they're so unbelievably fatty that after two or three, you're like, eh, I'm good. Like I could sit down if you're doing ribs right and you don't sauce them too much and the rub isn't too sweet, like you can easily put down an entire rack of grilled or smoked ribs, like easily without even thinking. But pork belly burnt ends seem like kind of a delicacy. How many were you actually putting away?
Oh, that's a good question. Probably not a lot, because you're right. They're really, really filling.
It's like brisket.
Well, and I didn't even make a bunch. So I kind of made them as like a side dish. I just did regular like chicken thighs on the grill, just kind of barbecue chicken thighs that my kids really like. And I just kind of did them as sort of a side thought. All right, I'll give this try one more time because I had some left over from last time. And I can't tell you how happy I was to finally get that right because I ruined so much pork belly.
How'd your fantasy teams do this past week? We do have some fantasy implications on Monday night, but it does seem like you're slipping inevitably towards irrelevance, as you tend to do.
I think that was uncalled for. My quarterback got hurt halfway through the game, Justin Fields. That probably didn't help out. George Kittle
out for
got me
several
exactly,
weeks. Surgery is a consideration.
George Kittle got me exactly 1 point, so that's not going to be helpful at all. So no, it wasn't a great week. So I will take my first loss. I think that'll still leave me in second place, though. Which is how many spots ahead of you is that?
One. I'm currently projected to beat your youngest son by 0.4 of a point. ESPN projections, though, as we know, tend to be wildly, wildly inaccurate. All right. That's going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lab. Make sure you check out Rex. I'm not sure they're going to put him on air from the Live Miami event, but if they do.
Oh, you're wrong. Just got an email. You need to look it up. We're going to do a roundtable tomorrow, on Wednesday. So they inevitably put me on air.
TBD on that, to be sure. If not, go to NBCSports.com/golf for all the latest news, notes, features, commentary, videos, and yes, this here podcast. Thank you guys for listening. We'll be back next week for another episode.
Pick up the check, Russ. Come on, you can expense it.